Now it is my great pleasure as we begin to introduce the three state lawmakers who kindly agreed to make their schedules work to be with us here today. And we do very much appreciate the fact that they could have been elsewhere, but they chose to be here. We thank them for that. Right on my left is Kyle Casale, a Republican of College Station, first elected to represent House District 12 in 2012. Like all House members, he is on the ballot in 2014, but after prevailing in the Republican primary, has no opponent from any party.
Correct.
This fall, so he has effectively won a second term. So congratulations to you.
Thank you.
In the 83rd legislative session, Representative Casale served on the Environmental Regulation and Agriculture and Livestock Committees. A native of Pearland, he has an undergraduate degree in political science from Texas A&M University and a certificate in ranch management from Texas Christian University. On his left is John Rainey, Republican of College Station, who won a special election in late 2011, to represent House District 14 after longtime incumbent Fred Brown's retirement. And he successfully ran for re-election the next year. This fall, he faces both a Democrat and a Libertarian. In the 83rd session, Representative Rainey served on the Appropriations, Higher Education, and Administration Committees. A sixth-generation native of Walker County, he has a Bachelor of Business Administration degree from Texas A&M. And then finally, as he just described himself coming up here on the far right of the stage, Charles Schwertner, Republican of Georgetown, elected to represent Senate District 5 in 2012. He is also running for re-election this year, and he too has a Democratic and Libertarian opponent, two opponents, in November's general election. Previously, he spent one term in the Texas House representing District 20. In the 83rd session, Senator Schwertner was vice chairman of the Government Organization Committee and served on the Criminal Justice, Health and Human Services, and Agriculture, Rural Affairs, and Homeland Security Committees, a sixth-generation native of Williamson County. He has a degree in pharmacy from the University of Texas at Austin and a medical degree from the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston. Please join me in welcoming the Honorable Kyle Casale, John Rainey, and Charles Schwertner. I should say that Representative Casale has been with us before at Baylor. Dr. Schwertner has been with us before at both Southwestern University and at Sam Houston State. So I'm going to start with Representative Rainey, since he is least likely to know where I'm going with this. Representative, yesterday the Dallas Morning News reported, let's begin with public education. Yesterday the Dallas Morning News reported that after you all put a couple of billion dollars, I think it was $3.5 billion in total, back into public education in the 83rd session, Texas has moved up in per-student spending nationally from 49th to 46th. We're 46th in the country now in per-student spending. We are a little bit more than $2,000 per student below the national average. We're talking about public education funding now and always. We'll always be talking about public education funding in this state. Do you think we spend enough money? Does the ranking concern you? Do we spend enough money on public education in this state to get the outcome we want?
That's a tough question. First of all, if we're comparing ourselves to some of the states that have a higher cost of living, I think that ranking may be affected. I don't know how the ranking is determined.
Yeah.
I think that what we need to be looking at more so than money is outcome, and I think we're doing a pretty fair job. We need to improve.
Yeah.
There may be need for more money, but we need to listen to our educators and see, and there. With the very good economy that we had, there may be some more money for our education next session.
Right.
But there's going to be a lot of jockeying for position,
right,
for money, as always.
Senator Schwertner, Representative Ryan Rainey is no doubt correct. We may have more money next time than we had this time. We certainly had more money this time than we had the previous time. But everybody wants a piece of the budget, and there'll be a lot of competing priorities. Where would you put public education in the hierarchy of the priorities that we might look at in the next session?
I believe it's the highest priority.
You think it's at the top?
Yes. Article 7 is a mandate constitutionally requires that the Texas legislature provide for an efficient system of public free schools. But in the larger sense, we need to look at not just the dollars, the adequacy of the funding of public education, but how are those dollars being utilized? Are we getting them into the classroom? What are we able to achieve with the dollars that are going to the school districts? In addition, we got to look at the equity of how we fund our Texas public school systems. And we did a lot of work in that this last session in reference to making sure that the target revenue amounts for the lower target revenue school districts were increased more than the ones with the higher target revenues.
Right.
And finally, we got to look at the efficiency of those dollars. And we did a transformational bill, law now, HB 5, that allows for school districts to utilize that funding to provide for opportunities for every child to succeed for career and technical education, as well as to prepare students to go to 2-year and 4-year degree institutions.
So you believe mechanisms in place for that kind of efficient use of those dollars?
HB 5 was a significant step forward for the state of Texas in reference to public schools.
Got it. Representative Casale, you know we have a school finance lawsuit that is not yet done working its way through the courts, something like 600 school districts joined together. And this is not the first time this has happened. It seems like we're in an endless cycle of, every couple of years we have another lawsuit over public education funding. And this one is now in the appeals process, or about to be. A district judge in Austin decided that the school districts were correct, that the system of funding public education was unconstitutional, and now the state is going to appeal this decision to the Supreme Court. We're not going to yet know for a while what the outcome of this is. Do you think that we should be arguing with school districts, or are the school districts correct in their concerns that the system we have in place may not be the best system to fund public ed?
I think they're always going to have concerns. I'm going to side with my senator. HB 5 is huge. Let's concentrate on what we can work on.
Right.
I've been with both my education service centers. I obviously serve Region 12 and 6, working with superintendents, helping implement HB 5, and these vocational opportunities for the kids, especially in rural Texas, are huge.
Yep.
And, the smaller school districts don't have the revenue to have different curriculum departments, so HB 5 is huge. I hate the fact that we're waiting on the courts, but it is where we are. And so in this time, I'm visiting with all my ISDs, and let's hopefully can implement HB 5 to the best of our ability.
Right, and hopefully, Senator Schwertner, prepare for whatever the outcome is. I mean, obviously, not knowing, you've got a little bit of time before you go back into session.
I think the adequacy question is going to be answered in the courts, and we as a legislature will deal with that. But we worked significantly on the efficiency, and we also worked significantly on the equity portions of having functioning, quality public education institutions in Texas.
And as we said, you put about $3.5 billion all together back into the system in the last session. Representative Rainey, Senator Schwertner says public ed's at the very top, and I know he's being sincere in his view of that. There are people who would tell you that the physical infrastructure issues that the state is grappling with now may be as important. Water and transportation specifically. We've come out of the worst one-year drought in the history of the state, put a little bit of money out of the Rainey Day Fund thanks to the voters in Proposition 6 toward the water plan. This November we'll have a ballot initiative related to transportation. But as the state grows so quickly, our dollars are limited, and the resources we have available to us, certainly on the water side, there's just as much water as there is. We really can't do much on that. What do we do on water and transportation? Public education is a big ticket item, but so are they.
Well, in order to fund education, we're going to have to do something about water, and we're going to have to do something about transportation.
How are they related?
How are they related? They're related because they are the drivers of our economy, and by driving our economy, they're going to provide the funds for education. I think that transportation is at a very critical issue. I hope that we took care of some of the water needs with what we did this last session.
Right.
Transportation, to me, is a very big issue. It is one that if we don't make some kind of effort to solve it, our economy is going to not grow as fast.
So you think the argument for funding water and transportation begins with economic development?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Representative, there's always a question of whether we have enough money in the budget to spend. You know, the two competing worldviews are, on the one hand, we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem. And the other side of it is we don't have a spending problem, we have a failure to invest in the future problem. People who take that second view, we need to invest in the future, might say there's not enough revenue for us to achieve all our ambitious goals for the state, and that on water and transportation, we're seeing what the limitations of a low revenue budget are. Where do you come down on that?
You know, we're in a good spot. We are leading the country. Our economy second to no other state.
Yeah.
We have to have water. We're blessed with the oil and gas industry, and our economic stabilization fund is the key. We were able to use a little bit of that for water infrastructure, as you know. Do we go there again? That's going to be a debate we'll have on the floor, I'm sure. as soon as we get there in January, but these things are vital. We have to provide transportation. We have to have water. Right. As we have, you know, what number do we want to use? 1,000 a day, 1,500 a day?
I think it's more than 1,000 a day.
400,000 a year.
Right.
We're going to have to make sure we have water and transportation infrastructure. But going back with the good senator, education, there's the future generations. We're going to have to sustain this growth over a large number of years, not just the next 15 or 20. We need to look longer down the road.
Let me ask, I'm not sure that I got exactly the answer to the question I wanted, so let me ask it a different way. You know, I want to know whether we have enough money available to us. And as you've said, we've all talked about the fact the legislature had to go into the Economic Stabilization Fund, the Rainy Day Fund, to take money out for water and transportation. There are people who said, why couldn't you do it out of general revenue? Why did you have to go into the Rainy Day Fund? That might suggest to some that we don't have enough money in the state budget as it sits to take care of all of our priorities, that we had to dip into the savings account at a time when the economy is doing so well. So do you think we have enough money in the budget to do all the things we want?
We're sitting in a good spot. I think we do. But we did in the 83rd legislature, which I'm glad you gave me a pass on the 82nd at Baylor.
Well, you were in, yeah, right.
We still had to pay a few bills from the 82nd, and we did that and balance the budget. And so we'll have that same opportunity. But, you know, our economic growth and where we're headed right now, we'll be in a good spot. But we got to return to Austin in January. I'm looking forward with these two gentlemen on my left. I think we'll do what we need to do.
Now, Senator, you are one of the more conservative members in the legislature. You are not a fan of unnecessary spending. So surely you don't want to spend more than we have to, but at the same time, you know, you also recognize that there are limitations on the budget and maybe our goals are greater than what we have available to spend. So I want you to try to answer the same question. Do we have enough money in the budget to do all the things we want, to be the best at everything, which after all is what the state wants to be, the best at everything?
I'm not in favor of raising taxes on the hardworking citizens.
I like that. I didn't ask about taxes, but that's the answer you gave. That was a very good pivot.
You know, it comes down to priorities, how we spend our money, what we spend our money on. Texas is strong because of the tax policy, of the lawsuit reforms, and the regulatory policies of our great state. We are in a very fortunate, blessed position compared to other states in our country, and we need to continue down the path that we're going. Texas works. Texas economic success is not by chance.
Right.
And we need to continue with what's worked in the past in reference to making sure our economy thrives.
So you connect those things you name, tort reform, low regulation, all that, to the economic success we enjoy.
Fair and consistent regulation.
Fair and consistent regulation. But, of course, at the same time, there are people who will say, are we victims of our own success? You know, we've grown so quickly because of that economic development opportunity, but that growth is in turn straining the resources we have available to us.
Certainly growth has challenges, infrastructure, water and transportation and utility infrastructure, schools, for instance.
Yeah.
But we can meet those challenges with the continuing robust economy we have and the increasing sales tax revenue we have and the oil and gas industry that is really a renaissance for the state of Texas. We produce one-third of the oil and gas in the state of Texas, something like one-quarter of all the rigs in the world are in the state of Texas at the current time.
Yeah.
It is amazing. We're the only state with $1 billion or more in our economics in a economic stabilization fund. And we have upwards of $6 billion and close to 8 or 9 by the time the next session starts based on the severance tax at the current time.
You believe we ought to leave that money alone in the next session, unlike what we did
this
time?
No, I think we should be judicious in how we spend our money. And if we need to utilize it for critical needs of the state, high state priorities, I think we need to have that discussion and vote in both houses with a two-thirds majority to utilize ESF funds.
You have a sense that we'll come back to the well again, meaning the rainy day fund on water and transportation, or have we dealt with those problems satisfactorily?
Well, the water is, yes, you mentioned $2 billion, but it's a revolving fund.
Right.
And we will be able to fund upwards of $30 billion of projects over the next 50 years.
Right.
That's a significant amount. In addition, the enabling legislation mandated that the priorities in each region, the 16 regions, be listed in what they want to do.
Yeah.
So it was a hodgepodge collection, the state water plan, the $54 billion that you hear about. But now that it's prioritized and we have a funding mechanism and a revolving funding mechanism, I think we'll accomplish quite a bit in reference to the long-term water needs of the state.
Representative Rainey, health care costs in the state, as you know, have been rising at an extraordinarily fast clip. In fact, It is said that for a long time, the percentage of the unrestricted portion of the budget that went to public education was the largest, and that health care is now rising to meet that. It may actually, at some point soon, if it doesn't already exceed it, it may exceed it. What do we do about the health care costs in this state, and how do you address the undeniable fact, however you feel about the potential solutions, that we now have the most uninsured people of any state in the country? How do you square those two parts of the health care piece?
That's a very complicated issue. I think it mostly is an economic issue, and it is also an education issue. If we don't do something to train our people to do these vocational and technical jobs, they're going to be sitting over there and needing to have the benefits from Medicaid. What we need to do is make sure that the citizens of our state are trained for jobs, and then hopefully we'll rectify that situation. If we don't train our people, then we're going to be in a worse situation 20 years from now than we are now.
So you tie the employment level of this state, directly or indirectly, to the degree to which people have access to health care?
Yes, I do.
Right. Are you one of those who believes that health insurance ought to be tied to employment, or do you just simply believe that people will have more resources available to them and therefore they can go out and buy health care or health insurance themselves?
I think health insurance is going to have to be solved by the forces of the market.
Right.
And however that's done is it could be done by employment, it could be done by other methods, but it's not going to be government that's going to solve that problem.
So when you look back on the session, the decision made well before any of this healthcare.gov ACA fuss that we've seen of recent months, back in the session when the legislature said not just no, but heck no to the idea of expanding Medicaid or embracing any aspects of the Affordable Care Act, you wouldn't like to have that one back. You feel like that was the correct decision on the legislature?
I think we voted correctly.
You do. Representative Casal, what is the alternative to doing what a number of states, not every state, but a number of states did, and that is kind of holding their nose and taking the money from Washington? A number of states, including a number of red states, made the decision to do that. So we elected not to do it. How do we then attack the problem affirmatively of health care costs going up and having people who don't have health insurance in the greatest amount of any state in the country?
It is of essence that we get something done. I think there's a Texas solution out there. And, you know, I'm fortunate to have not only Dr. Schwartner, but Dr. Bonin and Dr. Sheffield around us. But we cannot be hobbled by the federal government. I think we perform on every economic level across this state, whether it's our economy, our jobs, and our growth.
Right.
Let us alone. Let us head that way with the health care
system.
Okay,
so
we've
got
professionals in the audience that I know can help us immensely.
So what is that Texas solution? I hear you. Let's keep the federal government at bay. So I'll grant you that. What is the solution then? What is the Texas solution? We hear a lot about a Texas solution. What are the details of that Texas solution?
Well, I'm going to need some help from the good doctor.
Well, I feel like Dr. Schwartner and I have been having a version of this conversation for going on 2 years, and I've asked you the question every possible way I can. So let me just ask it straight away. What is the affirmative answer if we don't like what's coming out of Washington? What here in Texas can we and should we do?
A public health system that is reformed in a manner that is a free market based, that's affordable.
Yeah.
For the taxpayers, sustainable, and reintroduces the individual to the consequences of their own health care choices, as well as it reintroduces the individual to the health care costs associated with the care that they receive.
Right.
That is absolutely the requirements of any health care system reform. But what Obamacare does, it was sold to us as access to affordable, accessible, quality health care. You heard that a lot from the president. You also heard that we're going to bend the cost curve down, $2,500, you can keep your doctor, you can keep your plan, all these promises. He overpromised, he oversold, and he failed. Because what large government programs do, add complexity, add cost, add control, and in the end, they tear down the confidence we have in government, tear down the confidence we have in our president.
So when you talk about this solution that involves people taking responsibility for their own health care and associating real cost with
sustainability,
the decisions people made.
Affordability.
When will we see the fruits of this idea of manifest themselves in Texas? If you make it sound easy,
right.
I know it's not. But we've had this problem of having near the top or at the very top of, in the country of having people without health insurance for some time. Mm-hmm. So why have we not done this previously if it's a good idea, and when can we see this idea put into effect?
Well, right now, because we're held hostage by our federal partners. We send our taxpayer dollars up to the federal government, and they return to us in Medicaid dollars, but with federal regulation constraints. I call those the federal golden handcuffs. And until we have a loosening of those handcuffs to fashion a Texas solution that incorporates affordability and sustainability and personal responsibility, we'll continue to have ever-escalating costs, ever-escalating attempts at controlling those costs by increasing mandates and pre-existing, not pre-existing conditions, but pre-certifications and just barriers to receive that care.
So is the issue in part that we need the government to give us effectively a block grant?
Give us
the money back that they would be giving us in the form of the Affordable Care Act, but just give it to us without strings?
I'll answer that in two parts. One, they've already done so in certain programs such as TANF. They did that in the 80s,
right.
So it's certainly possible. In addition, I think the federal government will ask for that eventually, will demand that we transition our Medicaid program to a block grant. And I say that because they are essentially bankrupt. We have a federal government that's running deficits to up to $1 trillion a year in the past. Now it's closer to $400 billion. And our debt's $17.5 billion. Our unfunded liabilities are in the tens, if not hundreds of trillions of dollars. Right now, they're rolling that over with increasing debt. And they can only pay the interest on the debt, which is 10% of our federal budget, for so long. When interest rates go up, that portion of the budget allocated to payment of the federal debt, interest on the debt, will get larger. They will look for a way out, and they will want the states and the uncertainty associated with our health care entitlement programs to have certainty in those budgetary dollars. And they will then look toward the options of having a block grant. So I would say it's a inevitability rather than an option.
Yeah. Mr. Rainey, there are a lot of people who will say, you know, we don't like what's coming out of Washington on health care, but that's an awful lot of money to be leaving on the table. And in fact, what you see at the county level, I don't know if in this county it's the case, but it's been the case in a lot of the big urban counties, the county judges have been the loudest advocates for holding their noses and taking the money, because they say the amount of money that is being left on the table is just too tempting. And we can do good with that. And the uncompensated care costs are going up so quickly that that's really the only solution we have.
Makes a good argument. But what I want to tell you is that typically what happens when we take this money from the federal government, they begin automatically to discount how much they're going to give us. And we're going to be in the situation of having to come up more money from a state's standpoint.
Now, what they're saying is 100% for a certain number of years, and then they go down to 90%. That's it. I know I'm not surprised to see Senator Schwertner is a little skeptical of this promise. But in essence, what they're saying is we're going to give you the maximum for the first couple of years, then we're going to take it down to 90, and we're going to stick. You're not buying it either.
No, I'm not buying that. They typically change their mind at some point and throw it back on the state. That's the problem.
Yeah.
That's why I like the block grant.
You'd rather just have them send the money back and let us.
That's right.
And let us deal with the problem. Representative Casale, let me ask you about a different issue, and that is immigration. There's some disagreement in election season and at all times over whether the state really can solve the immigration problem or whether this is really a federal problem. And this comes up in.
Correct.
We just had a series of very interesting and unusually competitive primaries in which this very topic was at issue. But we know that given the changes in the population in the state, we know that given the way the world has gone for the last few years, the immigration problem that we have and the problem of needing to reform immigration policy is not going to just go away. We've got to do something. So fight at the federal level over whether we should have comprehensive immigration reform and what that would look like. From the state legislature's perspective, how should we think about immigration? What do we think about it for a state like Texas, which, after all, is at the epicenter of this discussion? Our border,
we have two issues. We have border security issues,
right?
And then we have the immigration. Once they're here, and we're working with these folks, obviously agriculture and the oil and gas industry are dependent. So I love.
There's a workforce component.
Correct. So I still love the guest worker option. One, we have them identified, then they're contributing that, you know, part of their paycheck will come back to the state and help us cover the education and health care costs that we're we're taking on without any help at this point. So
right.
We got to look at the security. We got to look at a guest worker program. And then, you know, the optimistic side is that as the Eagleford Shell does expand across the river, we know that the Mexican government finally has opened up. And I'm hoping that we'll have some economic opportunity there, and that will adjust some of the immigration from the south. You know, right. I'm still more concerned about the 1,000 people coming from the other 49.
Yeah. Right, yeah. We haven't talked about immigration reform involving keeping people from other states out. Right. But, you know, Representative Casal, the Obama administration says that they have actually been responsible for more deportations in the last 5 to 6 years than the previous administration was, and that net migrations are actually at a recent, if not all-time, low. So is the problem as dire in terms of people crossing over as we've been led to believe, or do some of those statistics make you think that maybe we're beginning to turn the corner on that?
Well, I spend a lot of time below San Antonio. I don't know if they're going the other way.
You don't see evidence yourself. Yeah. Dr. Schwertner, what about this? How much of this can the state really do, and how much of this is more of a federal issue where we have to turn to Senators Cornyn and Cruz and the 36 members of the Texas delegation to advocate on our behalf?
Well, legal immigration and human trafficking is a very real and very serious issue, as is drug smuggling and the cartels. It's an issue vital to Texas. Security of the border is not just an economic issue. It's a very much of a security issue. And our federal partners are failing at fulfilling their constitutional duty in Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution, that we have secure borders. Texas has stepped up in that regard. We have large presence of DPS and individuals, law enforcement individuals on the border, and we do significant work in reference to interdiction of drugs, as well as working on human trafficking. It's important, I think, for Texas, who suffers the consequences of a failed federal program, failed federal enforcement, to take the lead in those areas, because I consider it not just the economics, but when I think about border issues and legal immigration, I think of the tragedies that we saw in Houston recently with 50 individuals locked up in a home.
Yep.
And the human trafficking issues. The people that should be most concerned about this are the people right around the border and the Hispanic citizens that we have here in our state.
Yeah. So this is there's an economic issue that ties back to workforce, as Representative Casal right. says. There's a criminal justice issue.
Right.
Right. Right. Representative Rainey, what do you think about this issue? We live in a community, we're sitting today, pardon me, in a community that is very heavily dependent on, reliant on agriculture. You understand where Representative Casal is coming from in terms of how this ties to workforce. In some of the southern states where they've done real hardline immigration laws, we actually saw some serious workforce issues in ag particularly develop. So we want to avoid some of that here, right?
Well, I agree with Kyle about a guest worker program. I think
yeah.
that's very important. Perhaps one of the reasons we have not had, according to the Obama administration, as much illegal immigration has to do with the failed economy of the last 5 years nationwide.
This is a less attractive place for people to sneak into.
Yes, although I think that Texas is probably the most attractive place right now.
Right.
I was fortunate enough last week to go down South Texas and go turkey hunting, killed two turkeys, had a lot of fun. But the important
thank you for sharing that with us.
While I was there, there was an illegal that walked up to the homes where we were staying out on this ranch, and they were dumped out and told that Houston was 5 miles from here. And that is just cruel, regardless of whether you think they should have been here or not.
Right,
and that's the part that is frightening to me, is the number of people that are taken advantage of and delivered to our country, telling them that it's just, you know, 5 miles to Houston, and if they stayed out there in some of that territory for any length of time, they have their life is in danger just because of going to run out of water and all that stuff.
Mr. Rennie, is there anything that the legislature can do? So go ahead to 2015. You now get to set the agenda for the House. Tell us what the legislature can, as a practical matter, do on this issue. What legislation can you pass? What can you do?
I don't know that there's any additional legislation. There may be some additional ability given to the DPS to work on that.
Right.
What legislation we can do, I think, still remains with the federal government.
Right.
I don't have an answer for that.
Let me ask the grizzled veteran of the three of you in the legislature, Senator Schwertner, who's been there going all the way back to 2010. if you listen to the lieutenant governor's race, the primary among the four before primary day in March, you'd think this was the only issue that was on the table in Texas. And there was discussion of giving health care to undocumenteds. There was talk about giving driver's license to undocumenteds. You had everybody racing to get to the right of one another on getting rid of in-state tuition. I guess those are all things that the legislature can have a hand in. But those really aren't addressing the question of people crossing over illegally. So let me ask you, is there a way that we can deal with the big problem, not the stuff that's corollary to it?
Well, you can look at the demand in reference to employers knowingly hiring illegal immigrants, requiring E-Verify.
You'd like to see a crackdown on that?
Yes, I would, yes. Sanctuary cities, same thing, in which municipalities put in place regulations or pass resolutions that they will not enforce our immigration laws.
Yeah. Now that kind of legislation came up in the 2011 session.
A lot of legislation came up.
Yeah. Did not go anywhere. The Senate is fixing to be more conservative this time than it was previously. You feel optimistic that some of that stuff that did not pass previously might pass this time?
Yeah, I think it's too early to tell exactly what's going to happen in the next legislative session.
I was expecting optimism on your part as far as that goes. I think, not sure.
If you look at the individuals that have been elected or are likely to be elected, you have a significant conservative tilt to those individuals. But I think we need to reach out to our Hispanic populations and make sure that we have connections in the border from a party standpoint, this is kind of a secondary issue to illegal immigration, but reaching out to Hispanics and the values that are espoused by our party and the values of Hispanic citizens, family, opportunity, jobs, life issues.
Yep.
I think we marry and parallel each other well in a lot of reasons, in a lot of aspects. And so, you say conservative. I think it's Texan. I think it's also Hispanic in that respect.
Well, you've gone there, so let me join you in going there and pivot away from the policy question and ask the political question. I'm up on stage with three conservative Republicans. Your party has frankly had a problem attracting votes from the Latino community over the last couple of election cycles, and there is this concern at the national level, at least, that the party may be shooting itself in the foot with some of the rhetoric that we hear and the tone of some of the language coming from candidates. And come back to this election cycle, I'll go back to the lieutenant governor's race. We had the spectacle of Latino Republicans saying that they were concerned about whether they could support a particular potential nominee of the party if he were to prevail in one of those races for fear that we're just running Latinos off from the party. So let me ask, as a practical matter, how do you sell the Republican Party as it's currently constructed, Representative Casal, to the Latino community and say you have a reason to believe you have more than one choice at election time? What do you do about that?
We got to make our message simpler. It's all about...
Message simpler.
Simpler. It's got to be economy, job opportunity, and taking care of their family. Simple.
Yeah.
We've broadened our scope so big that we lose a lot of them. Obviously, with the social issues that, you know, are true to my heart, but we saw there in the last session, we lost a lot of the Latino vote.
You think that some people in your party are running Latinos off in the way that they're talking about some of these issues?
To some extent.
Yeah.
They're more concerned about where their next paychecks come from, where's my job, and that's it.
Right.
Very simple.
Right. Representative Rainey, you're a person of moderate temperament, although of conservative ideology. You're not the kind of person to breathe fire on a lot of these issues. What do you think, from your perspective, what would be the John Rainey answer to how you get Latinos to look at the Republican Party seriously?
I think we need to be inclusive, and we need to work very diligently to go out and bring Latinos into our party.
Yeah.
We have done that, I think, locally. We have a very strong Hispanic Republican group that's growing, and I think that we need to share that with other places and actually make our efforts stronger. The basics of family, jobs, opportunity are the same for all of us. I don't care what race we are.
Yeah.
And I think that the Republican Party is the party that can represent those three elements the best.
Senator, you want to weigh in on this any more?
Certainly. I just say that I think our founding values, our American values, Texas values of liberty and opportunity and the individual correlate well with all individuals, whether or not they're white or Hispanic or black. I would say the party in opposition is much more about the state and entitlement and dependency and debt and, in the long run, despair.
And you think the Democrats are about despair?
I think it leads to that.
Well, you just gave the Eagle its headline from this event. I'm on a college campus. I don't want to be disrespectful. I'm on a college campus. So let me ask about higher ed before we go to the audience. The state's share of funding of higher education has been on a downward trajectory for some time. It's creating issues on college campuses where, you know, do we have to raise tuition in order to achieve our ambitious goals? There's a need for campus buildings on campuses, perhaps like this one, and the tuition revenue bonds bill that was in play during the last session did not go through. Have you all done right by higher ed? Have you adequately provided higher ed with the support it needs? A lot of talk about public ed, but at the end of the day, higher ed is producing the leaders of tomorrow in Texas. It's producing the next workforce, and there's some sense within the higher ed community that maybe the legislature is giving higher ed the short shrift. Representative Rainey, assess how well you've done for higher ed and help us understand what you're prepared to do in the next session.
Well, I'm going to support tuition revenue bonds.
Did you support them the last time?
I supported them the last
what
time.
What happened?
That's a good question. You need to ask the senator. It happened in the Senate.
Boy, I have to say, Schwertner, you're getting the worst of this today, man. Every hard question, they just say, talk to Schwertner. Well, we'll get you last. So you can't speak to why they didn't go last time,
but you will not
support them again. You will. Do you think the state is providing adequate funding to higher ed in the Maine?
Again, it all comes back to there's only 17%.
Well, it's a yes or a no, Representative.
Not a yes or a no. It's a matter of allocation of money. We only have 17% of the budget that we can divide among all of these these groups that want it because
So
much of it's dedicated.
Sure.
And as Medicaid grows, that 17% is going to shrink.
Right.
So we have to do something about Medicaid in order to support education.
So the competition between public ed and higher ed and health care, right now higher ed is losing because health care is taking up a larger portion of the
budget. Absolutely.
Representative, will you give me an answer as to whether you think you all are adequately funding higher ed?
We need to fund higher ed. But I love HB5 because that gives us opportunities. And when these children are graduating from high school with a two-year associate degree, we're making that cost of their higher education cheaper. So now that we have multiple curriculum paths, that's going to be very helpful.
So you think part of the issue is to get kids in and out quickly, including getting them in with more credits and get them out more quickly
rates.
As a result. You have any problem with schools deciding they want to raise tuition rates if they think they need more money to do all the things they want?
They ought to have that opportunity.
You think they should have that opportunity? Doctor, since apparently you solve all these problems, so go ahead. Dr. Schwertner, first of all, what happened on tuition revenue bonds? First of all, since apparently you know the answer. And what about funding of higher ed? Is it adequate, and will you see an increase in the state's contribution in the next session?
TRB's had a lot of personality issues and kind of Senate secrets, so I'll leave it as that. But here's the issue with higher education.
Will TRB's come back? Do you think they'll come
absolutely
back?
Absolutely, they'll come back, and
will
I will vote for TRB's.
Them?
Yes, I do.
You will support them.
Right now, when I think of higher ed, I think about making sure that every child that wants to attend an institution of higher education has that opportunity. And right now, the portion of state funding to our institutions of higher education is about 22%. That's a small portion compared to what it used to be for all our institutions of higher education.
Yep.
We deregulated tuition in 2003. And since deregulation, tuition and fees have increased 72% in the state of Texas. That tuition increase has has a circular effect, causing individuals and their students and their families to take out ever increasing amounts of student debt.
Right.
Right now, we have $1.1 trillion of student debt in our nation, more than credit card debt.
Right.
And that's unsustainable as well.
So what's the solution?
I would look at re-regulating tuition as one option.
So you would actually be for re-regulating tuition?
I would look at it.
Yeah.
I would look at it. There are definitely pros and cons
of
doing so.
Doesn't re-regulating tuition, though, take essentially the bullets out of higher ed's chamber here by saying you're going to limit yourself to this much that you can charge? How are they going to then have the revenue to do all the things they want?
The revenue would come from the state as appropriated by the legislature, as it has before deregulation.
So you think that the state might be willing to meet to kind of...
There would be some of that. There would also be some potential belt tightening in some respects.
Will you be carrying that re-regulation of tuition bill?
It's been filed in the past already.
Yeah.
But the goals of deregulation in reference to competition, lowering costs, I don't think have been met, in my own personal opinion, of looking at the issue.
Representative Rainey, would you be for re-regulating tuition?
I'd have to study that very hard. At the current time, I don't know how we could do that and continue to fund education at a level that is currently funded when you add in what the state does and what the tuition revenues are.
What would you say?
I've got some homework to do, but if the senator gives me his word that he's already studied hard, I'm going to get with him and we'll... I won't leave him standing there alone. I'll help him out.
Yeah, the goal.
Did you know that you had such a magnetic effect on...
No, I didn't. The goal of the higher institutions of higher education is teaching and research. And that's the focus that I, when I look at and talk to institutions, whether it's A&M or Sam Houston State,
yep,
or Texas State, that's what I focus on. And I go, how is this benefiting the student? And that's where I come down. And I will continue to come down because I represent the people of Texas and the future citizens, future taxpayers of Texas and the students of Texas. I want them to have access to a quality education no matter what their income level.
Got it. Okay, well, let's stop there. A lot more we could talk about, but I'm hoping that the audience, as is almost always the case, will have better questions than I do. And so let's ask you to raise your hands. We'll walk a microphone around to you, and we'll invite you into the conversation. Gentlemen in the front, and then we'll pick up some hands in the back. Sir.
John Nichols, College Station City Council. In the last 3 or 4 months, both the City of Bryan and the City of College Station have undertaken to regulate predatory lending in our two cities, adopting a pretty
more
standard...
More commonly, payday lending.
Payday lending and auto loan, auto title loan,
right,
lending, which is a substantial problem for many of our citizens in terms of trapping them in cycle of poverty and our offsetting our efforts to establish family financial stability and grow our local economy. Both cities adopted a fairly standard legislation. Other cities in Texas have done it in the last 12 months. The legislature was not able to come to an agreement on what they wanted to do in the last session. Will there be some efforts in this session to fill in and make a more statewide progressive approach to how we handle this problem?
Yeah, this has actually already come up, Representative Rainey, in the governor's race, right? That we actually had a conversation already about payday lending, and I expect we'll be hearing more about this issue again. What about it?
I think we need to look at it very closely in the next session. I didn't hear much about it. It wasn't in a committee that I served on,
right?
So it never made it to the floor last time. But I think it should be studied and dealt with in some way. I hate to see anybody taken advantage of.
Representative?
I think definitely it'll be one of the key issues we talk about. I'm looking at both our mayors in this metroplex. This is an urban area, correct, now? But you don't need to take away an opportunity for a family that needs money that quick, that needs regulation. They don't need to be taken advantage of. But for some folks, this is the only way they get by month to month. So as bad as they are, they're also an opportunity. But we've got to find a way to... I know Mr. Nichols and I will visit about this soon, but that would be my own concern.
Yeah.
There's not a banking institution that would lend any of these folks money.
Dr. Schwertner, there's got to be a place the two goals you're hearing articulated.
Sure. The unfair business practices of predatory lending will come up again this next session. It's was very divisive in the Senate. There was a significant floor debate at the time that this bill came up. is how do you go about doing it? Right now, we've let municipalities do it, which has a hodgepodge of various city ordinances and regulations. I think there is a role for the state to put forth a coherent, combined regulation for the state of Texas.
Good. Other questions? Got one here. Ma'am.
Yes, there's been a lot of publicity lately about e-cigarettes and the harm that they do. They're flavored in all sorts of candy flavors, and you're sucking in a whole bunch of nicotine. Is there any thoughts about regulating that at the state level?
Well, I think smoking is terrible, and the harmful effects, both secondhand and firsthand effects. But when I come down, I think of it as a personal liberty issue. I was one of 19 individuals in the Appropriations Subcommittee that voted against a statewide smoking ban, because I thought municipalities could do so at the local level, and businesses were already pushing smoking out of their businesses.
So even as a doctor, you speak with some unusual authority in that legislature, mm-hmm. as somebody who has seen the effects firsthand, right, on people of smoking. Even knowing what you know and saying what you've said, you still believe that the liberty issue would trump other considerations.
I'm a very strong proponent of protecting your constitutional liberties and freedoms.
Right.
And people do a lot of bad things for their own health, and it's unfortunate they do so. How much regulation, how much government do you want telling you what to do for your own good?
Either of you want to challenge a doctor on that?
Absolutely not, but I had never heard anything about, never heard anything about
e-cigarettes.
E-cigarettes. Never heard. I mean, it's a new thing to me, so I don't have any idea.
To answer her question, we will follow it. I thought they were just an opportunity for people to quit smoking.
I did too.
I didn't know there was a problem with the youth.
There's a full range of tobacco in it, and then they're flavored to attract teenagers. Cherry and strawberry and lime and all sorts of flavors.
Doesn't sound very good, to be honest.
No.
Other questions? And we have a hand in the back right there. If you wanted to stand up and use your outside voice, we'll walk the microphone over to you, but go ahead.
He won't.
I have a question about the death penalty.
Okay.
As you're probably aware, last year the American Bar Association completed its assessment of the Texas capital punishment system. The team simply tried to see whether or not Texas had sufficient checks and balances to ensure fairness in selection of offenders receiving the death penalty,
right.
reduce the extent of executing the innocent, and preserve public confidence. They concluded, in many areas, Texas appears to be out of step with better practices implemented in other capital jurisdictions, fails to rely upon scientifically reliable methods and processes. So my question is, do you agree with the ABA that the capital punishment system in Texas is unreliable and arbitrary? And if so, would you be open to reforming some of the laws to along the lines advocated by the ABA?
I think we just had a judge in Oklahoma actually gave a very un-Oklahoma-like ruling on this issue this last week. There seems to be some movement in the direction of casting aspersions on this. There doesn't seem to be any, Dr. Schwertner, any great movement to overturn or to modify the death penalty here. So what about to the questioner's point about concerns about best practices?
Yes, I've always been someone that believed that the death penalty was a true deterrent and that there were some crimes so heinous that a death penalty was warranted. I live, with the Michael Morden issue in Williamson County happening in Georgetown.
Right.
And serving on the Criminal Justice Committee, hearing the testimony, my foundation of belief in that has been shaken somewhat, and I continue to look at the death penalty. I'm not as strong in my belief that the death penalty is an absolute correct way of handling it. Because if you have situations in which you don't have, you know, the DNA evidence and exculpatory evidence that was either quashed or hidden or not available, and then you put someone to death, what, you know, you can't, they're dead. And so
right.
should we continue to have, what's going to be in the future in reference to evidence and discovery?
Yep.
And is a death penalty still a warranted sentence in light of the potential out there.
It sounds like your concern is with whether the criminal justice system is operating.
Yes. I guess it was shaken not so much in the death penalty for those heinous crimes, but so much it was shaken in my the actual, I guess, criminal justice system.
On the innocence question.
Yeah, I guess that's correct.
Right. Anybody else? We have time for a couple more.
We answered everything.
Yeah. Okay. I've always got the killer last question if somebody in the audience doesn't ask one. So, okay.
No, I just thought I would come back to the support of higher education issue. Last year, I remember going to a seminar where we had a speaker from one of the eastern states, and he was working at one of the universities there. And he said that our institution used to be referred to as a state-supported university. And today, I would call it a state-affiliated university. And there's talk that in the future, it may become a state-located university. And I just wondered what your thoughts are on what the future of Texas A&M is in that scenario.
I guess over at UT, there was some discussion that there was the percentage of state funding had gone down so far that the state was at risk of being out of compliance with the constitutional provision of providing a university of the first class. If you get the percentage of state funding down to 8% or 7%, are you really providing? I mean, I think the questioner's point, which is obviously made it with a certain amount of humor, is not that far off in the minds of some people. Where is the state's obligation to do this? And at what point does the relationship with the state become something different from what it is? Representative Casal.
State funded, state located.
Yeah.
I think we have an obligation. And so, obviously.
Is there a floor that you would say can't go below this percentage? I mean, is there some measure that tells you we've gone too far?
Well, obviously, there's going to have to be now. So let's. I can't wait to get back and get on this. And I look at the brain trust over there that I have in those fine gentlemen. I look forward to working with them to know where that's going to be and what we can do to help.
Representative.
We do have an obligation to make sure higher education is funded just like we do with public education. At what level is going to be determined by what money we have. And it always comes back to money. I don't care what we do. It comes back to money in our homes. It comes back to money at the university. I would hope that we would have enough money to fund higher education at a better level.
Right. Well, obviously, you've said, Senator, that maybe re-regulation of tuition and reinstating some of that state funding might be one route out of this.
It is one option, one potential avenue to consider. If you look at the totality of the budget, though, and I want to hit this really hard because y'all understand, Medicaid is growing at 2.5 times the rest of the budget. Right now, our all funds budget was $197 billion for 2 years. Medicaid was 58.2. Health and Human Services in totality was 74. It is now, Medicaid is 30% of our state budget. In 1987, it was 11%. As the portion of our state dollars that's allocated to health and our welfare program, Medicaid, increases, it correspondingly puts significant stresses on higher education, public education, and infrastructure development.
Right.
And that's a real issue,
not
just in this state.
Yeah, if you assume the issue is not that we should grow the budget
larger.
I know you do not think that.
I think we are growing our budget in line with population and inflation, and I think that's a reasonable budget.
Do you think we're growing our budget in line with population? We went from 20 million Texans in 2000 to about 26.5 million today. We are growing very
fast. Are you about to argue it's growing faster?
Well, I'm wondering if the state budget is in fact growing. You're satisfied that the state budget is growing adequate to the growth in the population?
Yes. If we had the ability to prioritize with increased or less constraint placed upon us by the various programs that have federal dollars and have significant regulations and those golden handcuffs that come along with them.
Well, there need to be, let me just sort of pick off on this before we go to another question. Does there need to be some kind of revision of our tax policy going into the next session? We've heard a lot about tax relief during this session for taxpayers. We've heard a lot about the your party's nominee for comptroller is on record as talking, your colleague Senator Hager is on record as talking about getting rid of the property tax and possibly going to a consumption-based tax. There's talk about somehow going back to the pre-margins tax, business tax period. What should tax policy changes look like in the next session, and how do they impact this discussion of revenue?
Well, we're not going to raise taxes, and we're not going to have a state income tax.
Right. So put those.
I kind of like the idea under Senator Williams. We had a billion-dollar tax cut this last session. I kind of like the idea of revisiting a tax cut for the hardworking taxpayers of Texas.
The economy is doing so well. More money coming into the budget.
I think we'll come into the session plus $5 billion, I believe, is what the latest estimates are. I might be wrong about that. And then you have the amount in the ESF. How much money should we take out of your pockets to fund various aspects of state government? That's a balance, or is it better spent by you in whatever your dreams and pursuits are?
You might be an advocate for tax relief.
I'm always an advocate for tax relief.
Yeah, but if there's money available in terms of returning some of those dollars back to taxpayers.
Yes.
What about getting rid of the property tax?
What I've read about it, I don't think that's possible. We have significant amounts of local. No, I don't believe that is the right path for Texas.
Either of you believe that getting rid of the property tax and replacing it with a consumption-based tax is a good idea?
There was an element before last session that wanted to do away with the property tax and raise the sales tax to something like 17%. I think that's a crazy idea. It drives business out of our state. It drives retail sales out of our state. As a retailer, which I've done all my life, it's going to drive people to the Internet.
It's also a regressive tax, isn't it?
It is very regressive. Yeah. But it's more, we have to stay in balance with what other people are doing. If we're selling things and our sales tax is 8%, and Louisiana's is 8%, and other parts of the world are in that ballpark, we're all right. If we go to 17%, then we're out of balance.
Even if you drop the property tax corresponding with that, then you agree?
Yes.
Okay. Maybe we'll take one more?
Nope.
Well, we got
10.
Oh, my Lord. Where were you all 5 minutes ago? Okay. let's try to take as many as we can. Is there a microphone back that way? Oh, just stand up and scream. That's all right. Good. Thank you. Sir.
Hi, this is maybe a little esoteric, but a lot of the research we do at this university involves asking people out in the state for information about their behavior, about their health choices, and recently I've been advised that the Texas Public Information Act may require us to turn over data that we collect on our human subjects as part of a Freedom of Information Act request.
Because you are doing it under the auspices of the university.
Exactly. Right. So, if that opinion, which came from the University Counsel Office, continues to be in place, that really puts strains on our ability to ethically be able to collect these data on a wide variety of activities and our ability to conduct research on important problems. Now, I don't know if that's a regulatory matter or a statutory matter, but do you see any way to make some sort of exception for this kind of human subject data that we collect, totally supporting the general principles that underlie the Texas Public Information Act in the first place?
I find what you said very troubling, that individuals and their personal health information would be disclosed by an institution if under, you said somebody in the counsel's office?
Texas Public Information Act would have required right
disclosure. There's federal regulations in reference to privacy, the HIPAA statutes would trump that.
I would think that HIPAA would
trump
that.
It's not just medical
information. It's any kind of survey research you do. So,
it's not necessarily just medical records. It could be survey data. It could be, we go and ask people, do you smoke cigarettes? You could go ask people, what kind of behaviors they engage in, who are you going to vote for in the next election? Once we collect data at this institution, right, now it's subject potentially to a Public Information Act request, right, that, and we would have to disclose not just the data, but the collection instruments, potentially everything, even things that identified people who were promised confidentiality or anonymity, right? So I no longer make those promises in my own data collection because I know that in principle I can't honor them.
I would ask you to talk to my general counsel who after this. It's kind of in the weeds, but I do want to know more about it.
Yes, ma'am.
Judy Lee Eunice. We all came to hear what our representatives and our senator have to say. We expected to hear about immigration and the economy and so forth, yet they spent so much time dealing with women's issues and getting involved with women's decisions. Are we going to see that again in this next session?
you know, it's good to end on a non-controversial topic. obviously, issues related to women's health, abortion, and all that did consume a certain amount of time last summer, you may recall. It also consumed a certain amount of time in the previous session. What are we thinking will be the case, to the questioner's point, in the 2015 session? How will this issue play out, Representative?
I've been thinking about that a while, trying to see where we'll be, but I don't know how much time we will spend on it. I think we have bigger issues with transportation and education and water, and I think that's where our focus will be.
Of course, that's what the speaker said going into the last session. He said we're going to avoid distractions. People thought that was code for social issues that might blow up the session. And in the end, that's where we ended up, right? Whatever side of the issue one may be on, that did cause a kind of conflagration there at the end of the session. Representative, are you optimistic, as Representative Casal appears to be, that you can avoid a repeat?
Those are the issues that Kyle talked about that I think are the most important issues to our state. And I would hope that we concentrate on those at this point.
Dr. Schwartz.
I'm a very strong proponent of protecting life at 5 months of gestation and onward. The 20-week abortion ban bill that was passed this last session, as well as promoting women's health. I will always be an individual that protects life and protects women and honors God.
Are you satisfied that there is no additional legislation on this subject that needs to be brought up in the legislature?
I don't have any specific legislation that I, as a member of the Health and Human
Nothing's
Services
on your mind right now on this
That's
subject.
Correct. That's right.
Okay. Agnes, is that it? We got one more? Okay, we'll make this the last one. Sir?
School vouchers didn't pass in the last session.
Right.
Do you think they'll come up again in this session? And right. Do you think they'll pass?
Dr. Schwertner, you may have a presiding officer in the Senate who was the guy who was the advocate for as close to vouchers as we may be talking about as your lieutenant governor, mm-hmm. right? He may be in Dan Patrick. He could win that race. Mm-hmm. And one would imagine he's not any less passionate about that issue this time as he was last time. Mm-hmm. So what about that?
Yeah, Senate Bill 23 did not pass. But it's not direct taxpayer money being spent on vouchers. That bill was a equal opportunity scholarship that would have been funded by at a business level.
Yeah.
For individuals in need.
You consider that a voucher?
I don't consider that a voucher. A voucher is something I think that is state. That is directly state-funded.
State hands money to you and says, go across the street right. to a parochial or a private school. So the questioner's point, are vouchers going to come
give,
back?
We give tax breaks right. for all sorts of things.
So as far as they go, vouchers, not. But something like this that you're talking about may come back.
Equal opportunity scholarship is the term that was utilized on the bill. I think that's a reasonable synopsis of what it is.
Would you all be willing to support such a thing if it came back up in the House?
I think I probably would. I'm not particularly in favor of vouchers as a just open policy.
Because?
We have enough trouble funding public education already, and how we would issue them, how you would handle them, it's always going to be a question of how.
Yeah.
And I would be concerned about how it would be handled.
Representative, that is one of the arguments made. We have a challenge with public education funding now. Why would we want to take money out of the system?
And that's one of our obligations. We have to provide the best public education system we can.
Right.
And do vouchers help or hurt that?
But you'd be open to something along the lines of what Dr. Schwertner is talking about?
I've been against vouchers, but I would listen to him. But from the private or a parochial standpoint, those institutions are in a free market system competing for a college curriculum or athletic curriculum, and they do not want the state telling them how to drive their curriculum either.
All right, we're going to have to end there. It's been a great opportunity to sit with these three guys. Can you please give them a hand? Thank you so much.